Welcome to Agency Highway. This is a podcast for digital agencies and freelancers who want to grow their business, earn more, and work less. Each episode, you'll hear from agency owners that are killing it, meet epic people that can help you along your journey, or just listen to me ramble on about something I think is cool. Head to agencyhighway.com for transcripts, action notes, and to join the community. I'm your host, James Rose. Now, let's get into it. This podcast is brought to you by ContentSnare. ContentSnare helps digital agencies get content from their clients on time, in the right format, without email. If you've ever needed to get content from clients, you'll know how painful it can be. You end up constantly chasing them for weeks and months, and by the time it's ready, there's a 900-long email trail full of massive images and a couple of brochures from 6 years ago. ContentSnare makes this a thing of the past by collecting content from your clients in the right format the first time and does all the chasing for you. Try it on your next project by signing up at ContentSnare.com. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Agency Highway. This week we've got Drew McClellan joining us, who is he helps a lot of agencies with their business, you know, to help them grow and get more efficient and so many things. I'm just going to butcher the crap out of it, so I'll let Drew do the introduction to himself. Drew, let's tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, thanks. So I'm a 30-year agency veteran, still own my own agency. I've owned it for almost 25 years now. And I spend a little bit of my time on that side of the business, but most of my time is spent inside Agency Management Institute. And that is an organization that is born of the premise that most agency owners are accidental business owners, that they were really good at the client-facing work that they did inside an agency, and at some point either got downsized or frustrated or whatever and hung up a shingle. And at a certain point in time, as they were getting more successful, all of a sudden looked around and thought, oh crap, I'm running a business and I don't know how to do that. And so what we focus on is the backside of agency life, which is, how do you run your agency? How do you run the business of your agency in a way that is profitable and scalable and in a way that allows you as the business owner to actually enjoy the fruits of that labor?
I love that line that most agency owners are accidental business owners, because that's so the truth. I mean, we've all been there. I've been there. We were in a software business and suddenly people started asking us to build websites and we were like, oh, sure. And so that's how we did it.
Yep.
Ain't that the truth? So we spoke before that we're probably going to go down the line of financial metrics for agencies. And this is a very interesting topic because, I mean, I have my bookkeeper and accountant is talking about financial metrics all the time. And this stuff is so much over my head, so far over my head. So I'm really keen to dig into this and find out a little bit more about the things we should be tracking and why.
Well, you know, the reality is most agency owners did not major in accounting. And in fact, many of us avoided accounting classes. And so when we talk to our business advisors, our CPAs, our bookkeepers, they use a language that is foreign to us. And so one of the things we've done at AMI, and we've done this from the very beginning, so since the 90s, was we created sort of what I think of as a dashboard kind of set of metrics. So things that every agency owner can understand and can use them as sort of the litmus test to run their business. And these are now widely adopted throughout the world as sort of the metrics that agencies should look at, because they're different than the metrics that other businesses are sort of driven by. And so we've sort of jerry-rigged traditional accounting metrics to fit agency life, because agency life is different.
Right. So let's dig into them then. Like, what are some of the most important ones?
So I think one of the most important ones, first we have to understand, we have to have common language around adjusted gross income. And so when we talk about adjusted gross income, what we're talking about is when you pick up a trade pub or you talk about an agency size, a lot of times they will talk about, you know, capitalized billings or gross billings. And the reality is that those are vanity numbers. They're meaningless. And the reason they're meaningless is because they don't account for how much of that expense actually just passes through the business. So for example, I could have two AMI agencies and they both have gross billings of $10 million. Well, one is a media shop, which means that their cost of goods is $9 million and their adjusted gross income. So adjusted gross income is gross billings minus all cost of goods, including all 1099 labor. So anybody who does not get, who's not a salaried employee, somebody who is a contractor in any way, shape, or form, you subtract all of that out of what's left as adjusted gross income. And adjusted gross income is the money that an agency owner has to actually run the business of the agency. So that money is spent on loaded salaries, overhead, and hopefully there's something left over for profit. So,
right. That was going to be my question, is how does it like differ from profit? Because I know that's like a very basic one for people to understand. But yeah.
So adjusted gross income has profit baked into it.
Right.
But the way agencies should be looking at, so whatever your gross billings are is irrelevant. Subtract all the cost of goods out, take out all your 1099s, and now you have your adjusted gross income. And that's basically, just like we have in our personal lives, that's the money you have to sort of run your life, right? Mm. So for an agency, the adjusted gross income should break up into three, ideally into three buckets. And the sequences 55, 25, 20. 55% of your adjusted gross income should be spent on loaded salaries on people. 25% should be spent on overhead, which should leave you 20% for profit before taxes. And what I tell a lot of agencies is, depending on the kind of agency you run and depending on how senior your staff is, you might have a little fluctuation in those numbers. So your salary number, rather than being 55% of adjusted gross income, might be 60%. But then it's your job to make sure that you hold your overhead, rather than being at 25, down to 20, because ultimately your goal is that your people and overhead expenses never exceed 80% of your adjusted gross income, which still leaves you then 20% profit prior to taxes.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. So what is the easiest way, like are there accounting systems that can spit this number out for us, or is this something we need to calculate on the fly?
No, so any accounting software, whether it's a software that is built specifically for agencies like Workamajig or eSilent Partner or Advantage, or it's QuickBooks, which is really the tool that most agencies still use. Mm-hmm. Any of those, you can have a P&L set up so that it sort of subcategorizes all of those items in the P&L into these categories. So you can at a glance look at, okay, here's my gross billings. And then it's going to give me a subtotal for my cost of goods.
Yeah.
It's going to subtotal that out. It's going to give me my AGI. And then inside where your AGI goes, you just lump all of your people costs together, get a subtotal, lump all your overhead expenses, get a subtotal, and then you are left with profit. So remind me when we get done chatting, I've got a sample P&L that shows how you can set all that up, and I will send it to you, and then you can include it with the show notes.
Absolutely. That would be good, because this is the kind of thing I think examples are much better at illustrating. It's kind of hard to visualize this over audio. But what would make up your cost of goods in an agency?
So depending on the kind of agency you are, let's say you're a media shop. So going back to my examples, so I've got two $10 million agencies. One is a media shop. So their gross billings are $10 million, but $9 million of that is their cost of goods. It's media, it's software to run and purchase the media and all that. And they have $1 million left to run the business. On the flip side, my other $10 million agency is a PR shop. And they only have $1 million of cost of goods, which means that drops $9 million down to them running the business. Yeah. So at first glance, when we look at the vanity number, they look the same, but they're dramatically different businesses. Yeah. So cost of goods are anything that, in essence, where that you serve as the bank for the client, anything that you buy specifically because you are serving a client. So might be hard things like printing or media. It might be software subscriptions that you use to serve clients, or again, to plan and buy media. It might be social media scheduling software, anything that you wouldn't normally use unless a client needed it, right? So unlike accounting software or legal services or things that are just sort of inherent in running your business, these are expenses that you are buying really on behalf of your client.
So AGI, right, is the abbreviation for adjusted.
Yeah, adjusted gross income. Yep. Yeah.
And this is our, is this like the granddaddy number, like the main number we're focusing on? And so what do we do? Like we start tracking it, then what? Like if what do we do with the KPI?
Okay, so it's absolutely the granddaddy of all numbers. It is the cornerstone that tells you about the health of your agency. For example, once you know your AGI and you're tracking it every month, then you can use all of these other metrics that you and I are about to talk about to sort of gauge the health of your agency. So for example, for every $150,000 of adjusted gross income, you should have one full-time equivalent. So it is without a doubt, that's the most violated metric in agency life, is that most agencies are grossly overstaffed. And what that means is that we have, because subjectively, our people come to us and they say, oh my God, I can't possibly do another thing. We're swamped. We need more help. And without the metrics to sort of gauge that, we look around and everybody looks busy. So we go, oh gosh, we must need more people. And then we scratch our head and we can't figure out why we're not making any money at the end of the month. Well, the reason is because our staff isn't well utilized. So typically, many agencies sit at about $100,000 of AGI per FTE. So they are totally being underutilized. And the reason why everybody looks so busy is typically two contributing factors. And they both feed into this metric. Number one is agencies are horrible at estimating. Horrible at estimating. So we walk around and we say, hey, we've got this thing to do. How long is it going to take you to do your part? How long is it going to take you to do your part? And everyone gives you a number, 3 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours. But those hours are all based on an ideal that doesn't exist. Those hours are all saying, I can do that in 3 hours if I am not interrupted for 3 hours. I can work on it for 3 hours straight. I got 8 hours of sleep. I'm not worried about my mother or my kid or my wife or whatever. And so we automatically build estimates that come short. So number one, that's a problem. And number two, when we promise a client something and we put it in a scope of work, it is human nature to over-deliver against that scope of work. And if you don't have somebody controlling that, then what it means is we're pouring all this extra time into a project that the client didn't actually ask for. They bought a Chevy or they bought a mid-value product, and we feel the need to give them the Mona Lisa every time. And you know what? If that's not what they're willing to pay for, then we can't deliver it at that level.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was the key I was going to say there too, because sometimes you get clients that they order the Chevy and then they try to push you to create the Mona Lisa.
Well, and a lot of times, you know, we say, well, the AE should do change orders or things like that. But the reality is typically an agency's scope documents are so generic and sloppy that it's pretty hard to defend yourself when the client goes, well, I want one more revision. Well, if in the scope document, it doesn't outline that they can only have 24 rounds of revisions and they want 26, well, guess what? How do you argue that then, right? So again, it starts with having better control documents on the front end so that, and building out a scope and having a more accurate estimate. And by the way, the easiest way to get an accurate estimate is to run around the office like you always do and ask everybody how many hours. And then depending on how bad your estimates are, you take whatever that number is and you multiply it by anywhere between 1.3 and 1.5. And that's the number you tell the client, because that's actually the accurate number.
Yeah, I've seen a few different ways of estimating. Like, I can't remember where I was reading it, but there was a thing where it was like, this is the absolute like best case scenario, and then like the worst case scenario, and then sort of like finding the average of those. I can't remember. I'm going to have to look it up and put it in the notes.
And,
I think it was.
And would you give the client all three of those numbers?
No. There was a way to calculate the number based on like an average. Yeah. It was like, yeah. Can't remember now. It's like, I don't know, I shouldn't have mentioned it because now I haven't actually given a definitive answer. But I just found it interesting because there's quite a few schools of thought on estimating. You know, like we've seen different ways to calculate it, and obviously only give the client that one number in the end, and hopefully it all averages out.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, we're just not wired to be good at it, and most agencies don't keep accurate enough records. So what happens is somebody does a bad estimate. We deliver against the project, and then we go back into our project software and go, oh, well, we charged the last guy $10,000, and we don't really delve in. A lot of times we don't do postmortems. We don't record the fact, well, yes, we said it was 10, but we actually wrote off four. Mm-hmm. So it was really 14. So we keep sort of compounding and repeating our mistakes. And so what I love about the 1.3 to 1.5 hack is it just acknowledges that we're not good at it. And it sort of gives you that buffer to allow yourself to deliver quality work that you're happy with without, you know, losing your shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. You're just reminding me of, we found last night actually in our project management system that something we'd estimated an hour for had already chalked up 40 hours. So
right.
Yeah, that's a pretty big anomaly that we weren't on top of in time, which is not good.
No, and you know, every agency, this is a universal problem. Every agency struggles with this. And we all know that going back and asking for a client for more money, unless they've really changed the scope of the project, is never a pleasant conversation. So we're better off to sort of hedge our bet on the front end.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also improve our scope documents so that when a client does get unreasonable in comparison to what we sold them and what they agreed to buy, we have documentation that says, look, yeah, you know, in this round, in this section of the project, we agreed to 5 rounds of revisions and we've already given you 3 extras. This is it. This is the last one. Otherwise, there's an additional fee.
What kind of detail do you recommend people go to for creating estimates? Because I know like there's some people that don't even send detailed breakdowns to clients anymore. They're a big fan of just saying like, here's the website package, it's 10 grand or whatever. Yeah, versus some people who break it down into like, you know, this plugin or something has 3 hours set up. Like, how do you recommend breaking down scope?
I think there's a difference between how we figure it out and what we communicate to the client. So the reality is, I think the more detail you give a client, the more opportunity they have to nitpick to go,
yeah,
why would that take 3 hours to do this? My grandma can do that in 2 hours, right? So I think that's one of the reasons why agencies have moved to sort of flat fee project pricing.
Yeah.
Look, here is the deliverable, whatever it is, and it's going to be $25,000 or $1 or whatever it is. But I think we have to go through that level of detail on our end to actually put the number together. But I don't think we should share with the client because all it does is raise questions and invite, you know, their opinion.
And then I guess, though, you kind of run that risk or like if it's not in the proposal, then how do you fall back on like, I suppose you can send them the scope without the estimate.
I was going to say the scope is where you really need the detail, right? The scope is, you know, we're going to build a website. It's going to have, you know, here's basically, so first of all, especially on web projects, you know, there's the architect part of the project and then there's the actual build part of the project. And too many agencies lump those together. And so you're really if I said to you, hey, James, I want you to build me a house, how much is it going to be? You would immediately say to me, well, Drew, I have no idea. I don't know if it's a one story or a two story. And are you going to have a pool or how many bathrooms? And we skip that step a lot of times with our clients. So I think there should be a planning fee for the architect part. Like we'll design the blueprint. And then if you want to take the blueprint and have someone else build it, here you go. Or we will estimate it out and we'll tell you what it would cost.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to approach things, like a discovery phase and stuff like that, especially for the bigger projects. You know, like if it's I need a 5-page thing and like already know what the content's going to be, or it's a redesign of an existing site, you can see the scope, right?
Yeah.
But that was something we started doing in our custom dev shop. People would be like, oh, how much is my app going to cost? And it's like, like somewhere between 10 and 500 grand, you know, like based on nothing.
Right.
So we would do a UX phase and that's how we positioned it. We'd say, the most important thing to get right is UX, and the design. And then because, you know, you don't want developers doing the design because generally they'll mess it up. So what we'll do is here's a package, up to 10 screens. And once that's done, you can take it to anybody. We can do it. Someone else can do it. But you'll be you'll be in a better position, right? With this.
Right. You figured out what you need. And we think about that, I think quicker when it comes to digital products or deliverables for clients. But honestly, I think the same argument can be made for something very traditional. Look, we need to have a time to put together a strategy or a messaging platform or a marketing plan strategy, whatever it is. And then we can tell you what the tactics will cost. But all too often, we're so anxious to get the client to sign the document and to get started with the work so we can do the pre-bill and start bringing money into the agency that we take shortcuts that end up actually costing us all of the profit out of the job.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the other thing when it comes to pricing that most agencies don't do a great job of is a client will say, I want a, let's just say a brochure. And we'll say, okay, well, that's $5,000. As opposed to saying, well, here are three options for you. This one, the one in the middle, is $5,000. But if we strip away some of the maybe a couple pages or a spread or original photography or whatever it is, well, then it's $3,000. And if you want to jack it up another spread and you want to do this or that, well, then it's $10,000. By giving a client choices, we do a couple of things. Number one, we protect the integrity of our pricing because when we give a client a project with one price, and this, by the way, has nothing to do with agencies. This is just pricing psychology. But
absolutely.
When we give a client a project with one price, they immediately push on the price, and most agencies will cave under that pressure. So, you know, you walk in, you say the brochure is $5,000, and the client says, well, I only have $4,000. And after a lot of hemming and hawing, most agencies will go, fine, we'll do it for $4,000. And now what we've done is we've trained the client that we have no integrity around our pricing and that they should push on every price we give them.
Yeah, good point.
And when we give them two prices, they always, it's like the number is like 96 point something percent of the time, choose the less expensive option.
Yep.
But when we give them three prices, and you can see this in anything and in a no matter how expensive it is, like literally go into a Starbucks and watch how many times people order a grande versus any other size. When we give them three choices, 97.6% of the time, they will pick the middle choice. So agencies should build out their scope, starting with the middle project. Like this is what we really think they should do. And let's price it so that it is good for them and good for us. Then let's strip away some of the deliverables and then drop the price. And then let's add some bells and whistles, raise the price. And now they have choices. Mm-hmm. And the other thing it does is it says very subtly to the client, look, I don't care what budget you have, we can do something for you, but we can't do the same thing for you no matter what budget you have.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction.
Yeah. And this is a really good strategy. If you want to go back and check out like a really big discussion about this pricing, it's this episode, episode two, it's literally agencyhighway.com/2 with Corey Dodd. We have a big chat about this. It's specific to websites, but it goes into this whole strategy and he's a big fan of this three tier thing. I love it actually. Like, cause then sometimes maybe they'll take the big one as well and you'll end up with a lot more profit than you thought.
Right.
So,
but whatever you sell, at least you're being paid fairly for the work.
Yeah, exactly. So, are there any more metrics we should chat about that we would have on, say, a dashboard?
Yeah. So, one of the other metrics that agencies should be paying attention to is two sort of paired metrics. So, how billable is your staff, meaning how many hours a day does your team spend on doing billable work? And then utilization, which is how many of those billable hours actually get billed to a client. So for an agency, you need to take all of the billable and non-billable people together, and you need to figure out all of the hours that you have available for that group of people. And really, at that set, billability-wise, you should be probably sitting at 75 or 80%. And what that means is that your doers, your super producers, are probably billable at 85 or 90%, which also offsets the non-billable people like the bookkeeper, right? And then when you look at the utilization number, your goal is that, again, looking at both billable and non-billable people, your overall average utilization is 60%, so that you are making sure that you're paying for all of the non-billable time with additional billable time.
And I know, like, we've tried to do this in the past. This stuff can be really hard to track. Is this something you would, like, you'd expect this to come out of the project management system, right? And it would somehow have to tie in pretty well with your accounting. Do you have a good way to set all this up?
Yeah, I think it comes out of your time tracking software, whatever it is. So if you've got code, function codes that are both billable and non-billable. So if I am writing copy, it's a billable function code. If I am on vacation or taking my kid to the doctor or in an admin meeting, it's non-billable. So really all you're doing is you're just looking at all of the billable time versus non-billable time and figuring out what the percentages are. Then what you want to be doing is when you're pulling that time over to your accounting software and you're putting it against a project or a job, then you're tracking whether or not you've... So let's say I tell a client that a project is $10,000 and the team does a great job and is super efficient and we only spend $8,000 of actual time on the job. Great. We're going to charge the client $10,000. That's what they agreed to. And we, in essence, put $2,000 of profit on that job. So your accounting person, your bookkeeper, your CFO, whatever you're calling them, they should be tracking. That's called a write-up. So let's say the same project, we told a client $10,000, but we spent $13,000 on it. So now we have to write $3,000 off because we promised the client it wouldn't be more than $10,000. We didn't talk to them about any change orders or anything in the project. So that's a write-off. And you want to be tracking those two numbers against each other throughout the year.
Okay. So that's another great metric to have. Is there... I mean, I'm happy to just keep going on different metrics because I know we talked about talking about some research you guys have done as well. Like, what point do you want to move on to that versus?
So one more metric. For every four or five billable people, an agency can afford one non-billable person. So watching that billable to non-billable, and anyone who is billable at less than 50%, which means most agency owners are non-billable.
Yeah.
Right. So for every four or five billable people, people who bill in excess of 50% of their time, you can afford to have one non-billable person who may be not billable at all, like a CFO or someone like that, or maybe an owner who's maybe billable 20%, right?
Yeah. Or like a BDM or something.
Yep. Right. Yep.
Okay, cool. Well, there we go. That's a bunch of metrics that you can go away and see if you can calculate. I mean, that's probably one of the first things is making sure your systems are in place to be able to track these things because there is a bit of setup involved depending on what systems you're using already. But yeah, I'll put a list of these that we've talked about in the show notes and put in Drew's sample P&L statement so you can see what this should look like.
I've also got another document I'll send you that lists a bunch of metrics that agencies are tracking daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and annually. And you can put that out for folks to download too.
Perfect. I'll chuck that in the resources as well, taking a quick note so I don't forget. All right. So this was kind of cool too. Offline, we talked about some research that you've done on 500 plus CMOs around... when they decide to bring work in-house instead of using an agency. So let's talk about why this is important to know and what makes them bring work in-house.
Yeah. So back in 2014, we decided that we would do an annual external research project, and we partner with a company called Audience Audit. And our goal was to identify what is sort of a burning question or issue that agency owners are facing that we could sort of pick the brains of CMOs about. And so every year we go out into the field with sort of a different focus. And this last year, our focus was what is going on with all of the brands and all the clients taking work in-house and what's triggering this. A lot of agencies are finding that their clients are pulling more and more work in-house. They're creating internal agencies basically inside their own walls. And the agencies, some of the clients that they've had for decades or a decade or a long time, all of a sudden they're losing a lot of the opportunity to do work for this client. So this is a pressing issue for agencies big and small. It's really been a hot topic for the last year or so. So we went out and we talked to about 500 agency or clients of agencies. So they, in cases they were business owners, CMOs, VPs of marketing, whatever their title was, but they were responsible for hiring agencies and deciding how to outsource work to agencies or not. And we started asking them questions about what gets in the way of you giving an agency work. Are you getting internal pressure? to bring work in-house, which the answer, by the way, is yes. That many of our direct client contacts, the people that agencies deal with directly, want desperately to give us a lot of the work, but they're getting pressure from up above to try and bring that work in-house. Right now, there is a sentiment that it is less expensive. And it's interesting because this is a pendulum that swings. So I've been in the business for about 30 years, and we've seen this pendulum swing back and forth multiple times. But right now, the sentiment is try and bring it in-house. And I think there are a couple things that we learned that trigger this. Number one, one of the biggest frustrations clients have with us is that we are slow, that we are not as agile as we need to be, that we've created process for work, for taking work into the agency and through the agency. And in an effort to make sure that we have our, you know, ducks in a row, we've made the process so complicated that the clients can't get what they want in a quick turnaround fashion. So they believe, number one, that they can do it faster if they do it in-house. Number two, they believe that we don't understand their business and that someone has to be on the inside to understand their business, which is disappointing given how much time we spend trying to learn their business.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, having worked inside many businesses, I would say that, like, that's not it. Real, right? Like, there's plenty of people inside a business that have no idea about the business itself.
But this is all perception is reality, right? So, so they think that. Number two, they believe that we are better at simple tasks, and that when they give us things that are sort of complicated, we make them even more complicated rather than simplify them. And then the last big one that they believe is that they have to hold our hand through the entire process. So when we said to them, what do you want from your agency? Here's what they said. They said, I want somebody who is super transparent about their numbers, especially markups and commissions. I want somebody who can be super agile and jump in and on a project very quickly and turn it around on a dime. I want somebody that I can hand kind of a big thorny project and that they can sort it out themselves without having to constantly have me help them figure it out. That was sort of the damning sum total of their take on things.
Yeah. And so these things that we should be trying to, well, one, making it so we can adjust to things quickly and whatever, but is this language we need to reflect back in proposals and in talks with clients, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's something that we should be talking about. I think we should be talking about how we are set up to turn things around on a dime, how we are quick to respond. I think it's something we need to talk to the account people about in terms of if a client leaves you a message in the morning, you can't wait until tomorrow morning to call them back. They want that quick response time in everything we do, not just the deliverables, but in how we talk to them, how we communicate with them, how we get them information. And I think a big one is that we have to spend more time demonstrating that we are learning their business. So one of the trends that I'm finding that is sort of tangential to this research is many agencies for the first time are actually putting embedded employees inside their client's office. So as clients start taking more work in-house, one of the ways that agencies have started to combat that is to offer to let the AE spend anywhere from a day to 5 days a week on premise with the client, depending on the size of the client. And they literally have
an office. Just quickly, in case someone doesn't know what AE stands for.
So account executive or account manager, basically your client-facing contact person.
Yeah.
So, you know, these people end up having an office inside the client. They're getting pulled into internal meetings. And what I'm finding is that every agency that's done it was initially reluctant to do it. And you certainly have to pick the right account person to step into that role, because now they're sort of torn between two lovers, if you will, in terms of, do I serve the agency or the client? But every agency that's done it has been able to charge a premium price for that person's time and has gotten a significant amount of additional work out of that client, because now they're bumping into people in other departments like HR or R&D or sales, where maybe the marketing person would have sort of been a shield to keeping you from getting to know those folks. But when you're wandering the halls and when you're in meetings with them, it's pretty easy for them to go, hey, could you help me with XYZ? And the agency person goes, we absolutely can.
Mm-hmm.
And
next that is awesome.
Project. Yeah.
So do you think it's possible to split an AE between a few clients, like maybe 2 days a week in one and three in another?
Yeah, in most agencies, it is not uncommon for an AE or account manager, depending on what you call them, to split their time, whether they are on board at a client's, whether they're embedded in a client's office or they're back at their own shop, to split their time between multiple clients. So yeah. Sure, you could do that. Absolutely. Maybe they're not embedded in both clients. Maybe they're just embedded in one of your bigger clients and then they handle a couple little clients on the side, if you will.
Hmm. Cool. Well, actually, you know, while we were talking about this, I was thinking it was interesting with that pendulum analogy you said where people are going, like sometimes they think it's more expensive and cheaper because like I come from an engineering world and the same thing happens, right? Like my old man, my dad worked in a company that just all of a sudden decided contractors were the thing. And next minute, right, everyone is external.
Yep.
And then at some point they go, actually, we don't want to do this. And they're all the contractors are gone and it's all in-house again. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Well, and I think it also sort of aligns with the economic times of whatever country you're in. So I think when a country is sort of in a very prosperous time, then they tend to want to have more employees and they want to have it up more in-house. And as a recession or a slowdown starts to loom, then I think clients go, you know what, I gotta scuttle payroll, and the first thing to go is the marketing department. So I think sometimes it has nothing to do with us or them. I think it's just the economy also has impact on that.
Yeah. So, all right. Is there anything else you think we should cover?
Oh, we could talk about this stuff forever, couldn't we? I think the other thing we're seeing a lot of is one of the other things I think that agencies need to be kind of wrapping their heads around is the idea of how do you staff. So sort of flipping the coin around what we were just talking about. So there are still many agencies who believe everybody has to be an employee and has to live in your brick and mortar agency. And there are other agencies that are experimenting with being 100% virtual or being a hybrid where they've got a brick and mortar location or multiple brick and mortar locations, but they also have people scattered around the globe who have specific talents that they need and perhaps they can't find in their local market. So I think the whole world of agency life is in a reinvention period. And so we're seeing a lot of experimentation going on. But I will say, sort of closing the loop on our original topic, the one place where you should not experiment and that you really should have hard data is around the metrics of whether or not your business is profitable and is it serving you and is it worth taking the risk? Are you making enough money and are your people making enough money that it's, you know, that you know you're doing things in a way that actually serves the bottom line as well as serves the clients and the team.
Awesome. And on that note, I think we should wrap it up. I think there's a lot to think about. We've covered a lot of things in this chat, like a broad range of stuff as well that hopefully we haven't melted your brain because I'm feeling a little melted. My brain's
there's good. A lot of numbers, right?
Oh yeah. So okay, well, we'll drop several things in the show notes. So head over to agencyhighway.com to check that out. Grab the resources that Drew is going to provide. So Drew, thank you so much for joining me.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about Drew and perhaps work with him, head over to agencymanagementinstitute.com. Drew is helping agency owners become more efficient, to grow and become more profitable every day. So check that out. Or if you'd like to follow Drew on any of the social channels, it is at Drew McClellan. So that's Drew. And McClellan is McLellan. Of course, I will link up all of these in the show notes. So head over and check those out. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you on the next episode of Agency Highway. Discover how to grow your agency, earn more, and work less at agencyhighway.com. Head over there to get resources from this episode and full transcripts. See you next time. This episode was brought to you by ContentSnare. If you're a digital agency or just need to get content or info from your clients, ContentSnare can help you collect it on time and without enormous email trails. Give it a try at ContentSnare.com.